Welcome to Thinking Aloud, a podcast about the nexus of politics and all those things that make us human. From the Lindenwood University College of Arts and Humanities, I'm your host, Don Heidenreich. Philosophy is one of those academic disciplines that has often been joked about. Steve Martin once said, and I paraphrase, that you remember just enough philosophy to mess you up for the rest of your life. But interestingly enough, if you talk to people who study philosophy, many of them feel it was very useful in what they did and how they accomplished their goals and how many people who have degrees in philosophy become very successful. In order to discuss this discipline, I have today as my guest, Dr. David Brown, professor of philosophy at Lindenwood University. Dr. Brown, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Dr. Heidenreich. It's a pleasure to be here.
When we use the word philosophy, most people use it in this general sense. What is it? What really is the academic discipline of philosophy?
Well, I'll give a generic thing first. The words come out to the love of wisdom, and wisdom is understood as sort of seeing big picture things. Our former colleague, Donna Charon, said philosophy was reason in the world, and reason has two primary functions, that is knowing and understanding, and also in our making and our actions. And that breaks philosophy down into its basic subfields. We can discuss what is real, how we know what is real, how we should go about thinking correctly. We could do political philosophy, moral philosophy, and aesthetic philosophy. If you look at sort of the beginnings of philosophy, you had a group of people identified as the pre-Socratics coming before Socrates, and they were interested in what they called the arche, the foundational or fundamental principle of all reality. They were, in a sense, the early physicists, but they were trying to do more than just experimentations and observation. They wanted to know what is reality in its core or its essence. And you had answers like, well, it's air, it's fire, it's something like that. And philosophy has never sort of lost that quest to uncover what's foundationally real. With Socrates, you had a shift in philosophy to questions about ethics, which include both personal ethics and social ethics, which gets over into politics, where Socrates famously argued that the unexamined life is not worth living. And so philosophy then took on a moral dimension. And I think those are easy ways of looking at philosophy in terms of what it does in a very general sense. But also in disciplines, like you're a historian, there are questions, you know, what is history? You know, normative question, what is history? You cover that in historiography, which is really close to the philosophy of history. It's asking foundational questions that, as a historian, you could say what people have said about history, but what is it that you're doing? The same thing could be said for psychology and other fields. And you see this when different academic fields have a PhD, which is still common for scientists and historians and so on. And that shows that there's some philosophical connection, that there's a component to that, usually in sort of foundational levels, like what is science is not something you do in a laboratory, right? But you presuppose science means doing this, using this method, and so on. And philosophy looks at those kind of presuppositions, those foundational questions that the disciplines ask.
What are some of those sub-disciplines?
Well, in terms of the rational aspect that Donna talked about, what is real? Those are questions about metaphysics. We could talk, for example, about tables and chairs. We could talk about supernatural beings. And we could talk about things like unicorns. There's an existence that all of those things have just as objects of conversation. But most of us would agree that the existence of a unicorn is just purely a mental construct based upon combining other ideas together, where the table is something we encounter, we engage, we touch. You know, we consider that to be real. It exists in the mind and outside of the mind. So the ways in which things could exist is something that metaphysics covers. Epistemology and logic are sort of combined together in what are the things we know and how do we know them and how do we come to understand things in terms of their fundamental principles. Epistemology would ask questions about, can we know anything? Is everything subject to whim or social construction? And logic, which is foundational for the method for philosophy, Lewis Carroll put it this way. He said, the logic is about having clear ideas, making orderly arrangement of ideas, and avoiding mistakes in reasoning. And that's sort of foundational across disciplines. If you're doing a political argument, it has a certain structure to it. A legal argument has a structure to it. Even a scientific experiment has the same fundamental structure to it. And logic is the study that undergirds those reasonings that get applied differently. For example, in a legal setting, you care about precedent. In history, you care about documents and those kinds of things. In science, for the most part, it's what's the data right now? What am I observing right now? In terms of how we make things, the principle of aesthetics, should things imitate nature? Should things be beautiful? Is there some sort of obligation that a work of our hands be true or represent the world in a certain kind of way. And then we have moral questions, questions about how we should live our lives, how we should make our decisions, the values that we hold. And Aristotle saw the study of ethics as related to politics following Plato. Plato's having a discussion in the Republic about the nature of justice in the individual, the moral person. And he said, look, it's really confusing to look at something on a small scale. Let's look at a city. Because if we can find justice in a big city, we'll know what it is in the individual person, seeing that the political and the moral are scale difference. They're not fundamentally different from one another. It's a difference of scale. And so philosophers discuss foundational principles for ethics, moral behavior, and political science, in addition to studying foundational principles of other fields.
Do you also break out by specific periods of philosophy?
Yeah. And in that, we at least generally follow the historians. We're sort of at a peace with that. You have essentially the classical world. We're focusing here on Western philosophy. You have sort of the classical world, which has a sort of fixed time period from roughly the time of the pre-Socratics through sort of like the first century in the Common Era. The advent of Christianity played a particular role in both the history and culture of the West and also in the development of the West, because here you had philosophy, this body of teaching about nature and life and so on, and this new way of life. And the early Christians actually considered Christianity to be a philosophy, a way of life. Philosophy had a spiritual, in that sense, dimension to it, a dimension that was practical and how to live. And here Christianity comes along, and it's an alternative philosophy. And so the early church fathers had this kind of discussion of the relationship between this new faith and sort of the old knowledge, old wisdom, old teaching, and so on. And the medieval period is dated from when that synthesis started to occur. How do you sort of relate two different things you think to be true that in some ways don't fit? Then we also have the modern period. Renaissance sometimes gets lost in that. The transition to the modern period, Bacon, Galileo, Descartes, shortly after the Reformation, you have that. I think historians would generally place the modern period sort of in that time where you have the rise of modern science and a new way of looking at the world. You could also divide the world into the postmodern period, where that modern synthesis seems to have collapsed. And so we're familiar with post-structuralism, deconstructionism, other kinds of things which are reactions against the Enlightenment and against the Enlightenment project, or at least consequences of the failure of that to deliver what it had promised.
There are three classical philosophers that I think most people have at least heard their names: Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. What is it about them that might still be relevant in the modern world?
Well, Socrates raised questions about what we could know and about life in general. And so he would find people who claimed to know certain things, and he'd say, look, I'm an ignorant person. Could you tell me? And through a series of questions, he would find out that they didn't know what they claimed to know, which got him quite a following among young people and got him quite a few enemies among their parents, who later conspired together to trump up false charges against him. He's important because he brought this moral dimension, which is still important today, questions about duty and obligation and how we live our life. When we make choices in life about how to live and what we should do, we're examining our lives. And a lot of times kids today are in college and they go through thinking that their life is just going to drift along a certain path. Their parents have told them they seem to be expected to do certain things with their life and their career, whether it's family, getting a certain degree, a certain profession, or something like that. And here Socrates says, well, wait, think about what you're doing and think about why it is you're doing something. That's still very relevant. Conflicts between conscience and law are also important. When Socrates was wrongfully convicted, legally condemned, it was still an injustice, a travesty. Well, how do you deal with injustice and travesty? That's still a question we ask today. In the Symposium, Socrates, whether he's represented accurately or a character, it's the debate that's going on. Historians play a big role in that kind of debate. Questions about love. And we actually teach a course on philosophy of love here. And this is one of the foundational texts in Western literature about what is love. It seems to be something bigger than the human. So they called it divine or semi-divine or something like that. And here you see an account of love as finding your missing half, your soulmate, which is a common conception kids have today of love, right? It's becoming whole, complete, finding yourself. That came from a speech of Aristophanes, which is either an actual speech from Aristophanes that we just are unaware of, or it is so close to what Aristophanes would have said that Plato nailed it so completely that, you know, everyone says it could have been from his very mouth. And then Plato rejects that view. And that's kind of interesting because you read that story and it resonates with students and they, you know, this is how they feel. And Plato doesn't deny the feeling, but he goes on to give a different account of love, that that's not what love is. That's not truly what it could be, because one of the reasons he pointed out is no one would seek their missing half if that part they're adding on is sick or diseased. You wouldn't reattach a limb if it was diseased and would wind up killing you. If you found your missing half, but they were, for whatever reasons, toxic or bad for you or unhealthy for you, then being reunited with them would not provide you the benefit that you're looking for. So there's a moral quality to love that goes beyond just that. And interestingly, in that dialogue, he claims diadema or diatema is pronounced differently. A woman taught him the meaning of love. That's fascinating because in the whole corpus, Socrates goes about saying he doesn't know things. And in fact, his friend went to the oracle at Delphi who said that Socrates was the wisest man in the world. And he could only conclude that's because he knew he didn't know things. So here, a man who claims he didn't know anything said he learned about love. He knows this one thing, and it was taught to him by a woman. This is important, too, because we still have sort of a male-dominated kind of culture, and we recognize these kind of things. So to have like, no, the man who knows nothing learned something from a woman. And she presents a very, very powerful account of love that shows love being something bigger than just about the two people, bigger than just simply the biology, that that is sort of the lowest rung on the ladder to a lifelong quest for truth and beauty. And I think that's interesting. And so we talk about that, and I have some, you know, people who study psychology and so on, the idea of love as even erotic love in its erotic sense as a turn from the self toward the other is the same principle that takes you out of yourself toward a commitment to religion or politics or something beyond yourself. And that is what gives life meaning. Viktor Frankl in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, points that out. You know, the importance of finding something bigger than you to give your life meaning. And he took that to be fundamental to the human experience, to the human quest. So I think in that case, completely. Plato, you know, built on these ideas, and it's a question how much he was just sort of recounting what he actually heard and how much he was extending this. But the idea that the world is bigger than what we can see and touch, that there are what Plato talked about, forms. We point to individual things, you know, this chair, that chair, that chair. But what does it mean to make something a chair? Because that word chair isn't a proper noun for an individual. It refers to a group, a collection. Well, then there has to be some reality, some essence or nature that makes these things go in the chair box instead of somewhere else. And so Plato tried to account for that. Aristotle can actually be considered the founder of science. Armand Leroy wrote a book called The Lagoon, How Aristotle Invented Science. He's an evolutionary biologist from London, I think Imperial College in London. And he wrote this beautiful book arguing that Aristotle needs to be put back on the top of the heap, at least the equal to Newton and Darwin. Physics, chemistry, biology, in addition to logic and so on, he considers to be the inventor of these. Not because he's the first person to do it. He was actually trying to systematize and account for what people were doing in terms of meteorology, biology, chemistry, physics, even ethics and so on. And he pointed out in the case of biology, his biological works still have relevance today, that there were things Aristotle wrote that nobody could confirm or see until the 20th century, when lo and behold, Aristotle turned out to be correct. And this evolutionary biologist goes after case by case by case by case. There's a continuing relevance, and Aristotle has made a recurrence back in mathematics, in politics, in sciences, quantum mechanics. The founders of quantum mechanics said they're just dealing with Aristotle's principles of act and potency when they talk about quantum foam and quantum occurrences and quantum changes and so on. So they're abidingly relevant. They set the parameters and framework for the discussion, and they developed sort of the main lines that philosophers have pursued since then.
And one thing that we know from other fields also is that getting it absolutely right is not as important as starting the questions.
Right.
And I think in many respects, with particularly Aristotle, even if you can go back and say, well, the details aren't correct, but he asked the right questions and headed us in the right direction.
Right. And that's where the method comes in, right? That using logic as a method, as a tool for this. And you could use, and you could point that out, and you could say, according to his own principles, had he known things that we know, he would have changed his mind. Because in all of his research and works, he asks a question, an important and relevant question, and then what have other people said about that? And he'll record down that in case of the ethics. Everyone agrees that we do things on purpose. There's a reason we do that. And people understand that to be happiness. Why? Because that's the one thing we seek for its own purpose, right? We want the degree for the job, for happiness. Happiness is what we want. Everyone seems to agree on that, he points out, but they disagree about what happiness is. So he's not being dogmatic. He's just saying, look, here's the question. It leads me to this. Everyone seems consistent on this, but how does it work? How does it connect up to other things? And because he laid down that kind of framework, yes, he was wrong about, for example, gravity. You know, he's wrong about certain kinds of things. He's wrong about the motion of the planets and so on. But his principles allowed for that to be correct. His empirical, let's look at the evidence, let's examine the evidence, led the path to that. And sometimes Plato, there's a tension even in science now, particularly when you're talking about string theory and some really advanced kind of physics. Do you have to have observation and experiment for something to be science, or can it just be mathematics? Well, the pro-string theory people argue mathematics is sufficient. And the old school empiricists argue that, well, no, you actually have to have observations and data and tests. Well, that's a debate between Plato and Aristotle. And it's the same debate that goes back a couple millennia. It's the same debate that physicists were having just, it's been like, you know, 5 or 10 years ago in all the major scientific journals about, you know, what is science? And there's a big not with philosophers, scientists themselves are arguing, is science just about mathematics, which Plato would look at very favorably, or do you have to have observations and data? And that's Aristotle's game. So those are still present, persistent kinds of questions.
Are there other ancient philosophers, though, that we haven't heard about that you really think that people should be paying attention to because they really do bring something to the game?
You know, you had Lucretius and Democritus. You had early materialists. They're kind of interesting to look at. The Stoics are interesting. The skeptics are kind of interesting because we question what we can know and if we can know things. They had some hardcore skeptics back then that doubted pretty much everything. Related to sort of the area that you're working on, my dissertation research was on Cicero. Not his literary works, but his philosophical works have sort of been eclipsed. It's kind of amazing. I mean, I did an article in Teaching Philosophy, and they were going to publish it without correction or anything. They just said the editors and reviewers had a question for me. Why weren't they familiar with this work? And I had to do some research because that work had been used in colleges and universities for centuries. There's a period of at least 150, 200 years, you know, give or take, where every educated person in the Western world would have been educated in Latin, and every one of them would have read this book. It influenced international law, literature, politics. When Machiavelli, for example, said it's better to be feared than loved, he deliberately took that from Cicero and switched it, because Cicero said it's better to be loved than feared. He hated the Ciceronian approach to ethics. He full well knew what he was doing. He deliberately said, no, that's not the case. And so I think, you know, that's a tragedy. We've lost Cicero, I think, in particular from the ancient. And that's a tragedy. He has impacted the world in fundamental ways. One classic scholar said that in particular book of his was the most influential secular prose work in the Western world. Probably an exaggeration, but a work of that importance, a small, thin work that was used, written by a pagan for his son, that was adopted by Christians and accepted into Christian thinking through Lactantius, Ambrose, and Aquinas, who favored it enormously. It also found its way as a favorite book of the atheist David Hume and Voltaire. People of different political persuasions, of different religious persuasions, they loved this one book, which was common for everybody until toward the end, when the late Renaissance, not even late Renaissance, the second Renaissance, a guy named Theodore Mommsen was a back-to-the-sources guy, and he considered Cicero derivative of Plato and Aristotle, so he literally just wrote him out of the canon. I can't find any other reason why that particular book or set of books has been lost, except for the prejudice of one person who thought he wasn't original and therefore unworthy of mention. So a lot of my work has been trying to recover something of this book that has a long history in education, primary and secondary education, has been accepted and used by people of vastly different political and religious beliefs, Name me a book that Hume claims he goes to for his ethics and Aquinas claimed he went to go to on points in his ethics. Name me a book that you can find people like that going to. It would be a very short list if you could come up with that.
If someone wants to find this work, what title should they be looking for?
Well, that particular work is technically De Officiis. It's usually translated on duty or on moral obligation. It's a short work. You can find it for free online. And I use it in a few classes every once in a while as just an example of ethics. John Locke, by the way, in his letters, he was a great fan of Cicero. And in fact, when he was on his deathbed, he had already started a commentary on this book. He was that fond of this book. In several of his letters, he said, of course, if you want to study ethics, you've got to read the Bible. But outside the Bible, if you want the best of what the pagans have, read Cicero's Offices or On Duty. That work was central to his thinking, and I think you could find that, you know, among other people too, in the founding fathers of our country, for example, and other things. They knew this book. They turned to this book for inspiration, for ideas.
They regularly cited it. You find this in many of their speeches that they would talk about Cicero specifically.
Well, one of the things in my dissertation, I had a hard time finding citations in some cases. For example, Francis Hutcheson, who is a forerunner of David Hume in the Moral Sense School of Philosophy. It was really hard to find, you know, references. Well, fortunately, I found a couple of sources that gave me the perfect reason. They said, Cicero is so widely read and so widely known, you didn't have to cite it. Anybody you were talking to would know that. It'd be sort of like referring to the Bible in a culture where everybody had read the Bible. You didn't have to go, and that's in the Bible, because everyone knew that. So even where Cicero was not explicitly referred to, he could be quoted or cited because you just assumed everyone would know what I'm talking about. And that's how ubiquitous he was until fairly recent times when he's sort of been eclipsed and ignored.
Well, you mentioned Aquinas, and I'm always fascinated by this connection between ancient philosophy and the development of the early church. How does this play together?
Early Christianity had to place itself in the culture in which it lived. And so then the question was, how do we relate to philosophy, which was seen as a way of life? Christianity proposed a way of life. Are these in conflict? So the early church fathers had different opinions, like, well, their view is false and our view is true, or their view is not complete and our view builds on it and becomes complete, or their view had truth, but it's only because they stole it from us. So there are arguments, for example, that Plato and Aristotle stole from Moses. So if they sound in ways sort of close, you know, they did that. But what you have is you have the great theologian Augustine sort of defining orthodoxy in Western Christianity. And you still had philosophical learning and training and education, Greek learning and education going on. And how do you sort of reconcile these things? Here you have a belief in the creation of the world, but also a belief in the eternality of the world. I mean, there seemed to be conflict between what Aristotle and the Greeks taught and what seemed to be de fide, or according to the Christian faith. And Aquinas, that was actually one of his jobs. There were basically two faculties at University of Paris. There was the arts faculty and the faculty of theology. And they were fighting with one another because the arts faculty really got off on Aristotle. They really loved Aristotle. And some of the texts were finally being recovered from Islamic sources and so on. Made a big thing in the sciences, and the sciences were just all over this. And the theologians were like, you know, he's a pagan, right? He didn't really follow our teaching. And, you know, he could be dangerous or a threat. And so Aquinas was trying to honestly and sincerely look at this. Augustine, for example, in terms of ethics, Augustine in his City of God, I think it was Book 2, Chapter 19, I could be wrong in that reference, argued that the pagans who seem to have virtues are evil and demonic, and they don't really have virtues because you can't have any virtue, courage, honesty, anything without right religion. So basically, if you weren't a Christian, you couldn't be a moral person. Why? Because Christianity teaches that your goal is heaven, and heaven can't be achieved by your own works. Therefore, you can't achieve those excellences to get you into heaven. It has to be all grace. So the pagans were wrong. Aquinas, very sophisticated, in a very sophisticated way, has this sort of both and kind of thing. He didn't want to reject either thing that he thought to be true. He said, well, look, Augustine is right that for a Christian, our ultimate goal is to be with in heaven with God, to be reunited with God. And Augustine was right that according to Christian teaching, that's something you can't do on your own. It requires God helping you. The pagans, on the other hand, who didn't have that goal, right, and therefore, you know, couldn't have the right means, the pagans, he said, had a right view of how to live life in this world. And Augustine pointed out that actually, if you look in Scripture, you look in Genesis, Adam and Eve were given a twofold task, one toward God and one toward each other in the world. And so Aquinas said, look, there are actually two destinies for human beings. We have two goals, life in this world and life in the next. Augustine's right, life in the next is the most important, but life in this world is also a legitimate goal that needs to be pursued as part of that. And life in this world, the pagans were right, you could develop virtues on your own. You could become honest and so on and so forth. But the virtues that get you into heaven, faith, love, hope, the theological virtues, have to be given by grace or infused. So Augustine divided the virtues into sort of secular common virtues that help us live in this world and the theological virtues, cardinal virtues and theological virtues, which relate us properly to God, which have to be done by God himself. So he accepted Augustine in the big picture. He said Augustine was a little too harsh on the pagans. So he created the synthesis, which also synthesized faith and reason, therefore religion and science. And we kind of forget because you have that Galileo thing in our head, which we don't really understand correctly for the most part, right? We have this idea, there's really no conflict. If you look back at the development of modern science, you find not just religious people, but priests and bishops actually developing disciplines, being famous in science. There's a whole list of, you can find it on Google, famous scientists who happen to be priests. There is no conflict between them. And that's sort of that Augustinian point of view, that kind of both and, that there's a distinction, but there's not a contradiction. There's not a tension. Pascal put it very well, I think. He said, look, faith doesn't go against reason as contradicting it. It goes beyond reason. It tells us what reason can't tell us. And there's an element of humility to that, right? We don't know everything and we can't know everything. Well, then that means there are things out there, you know, beyond our knowledge. I had a question that came up in class the other day about logic. It's like, well, not all knowing has to be conceptual and this kind of rigid sort of understanding. I said, well, that's true. You know, scientific knowledge, intellectual knowledge involves categories. You can't be a scientist and not think about electrons as a whole. You don't name an electron and say, I'm going to study Timmy, you know, the electron. No, I'm using that as representative of a class or a group. You have to think that way. But not all knowledge is scientific or rational. There's an experiential kind of knowledge that the way we know and engage things goes beyond that. That's important, particularly for people in the sciences and the health sciences and so on, because however you classify or categorize a person, they're bigger than your boxes. They're bigger than your categories. And that's important to recognize. You know, insofar as I'm dealing with a patient, yes, they may fit this category. They may have this psychological type, this physical, you know, whatever. But the reality as an individual goes beyond that. It goes beyond rational knowing and rational knowledge. And that's an important thing to know. And Aquinas, you know, sort of brought these two things together, where there weren't the two cultures that C.P. Snow talked about, you know, the sciences versus the humanities. They were part of a whole. That's the whole idea of a university. You have things are united together. They're related together. And what we have today, you know, is so specialized and separated and divided, it's even hard to talk to people sort of outside of your discipline. And even within a discipline, they get so specialized, it's hard to talk. Think about the last time you went to a doctor. You know, if you've ever gone to a doctor and you need a test or something like that, that they can sign off for the test, but they can't do it. And they can't even interpret the results of the test. They got to go to another doctor who will explain to your doctor what's going on because, you know, your doctor doesn't understand. He or she can't do the test or look at the data and go like, oh yeah, this is a situation. No, they got to send it out, sometimes to two or three people before it gets back to you. They're not all on the same page. You know, it takes different people to do that. But anyway, that's enough about that.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. Really do appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be back soon.